Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we are going to chat about the 60th anniversary of the laser, go to an online geosciences conference, and talk about the challenges of finding an environmentally friendly alternative to the plastic wrapper that we use to mail Physics World magazine. Teledyne Hastings Instruments is proud to sponsor this podcast from Physics World. For over 75 years, Teledyne Hastings has provided reliable vacuum gauging and precision mass flow controllers and meters. We were trusted to help bring home the moon rocks. Let us help you with your toughest vacuum and flow applications. Visit us at teledyne-hi.com. This month, the laser turns 60, which is definitely something to celebrate. Capable of delivering intense and coherent beams of light, the laser is at the heart of many modern technologies. Indeed, I think you'd be hard-pressed to name any aspect of modern life that is not made possible by the laser. I'm joined by Physics World's Margaret Harris to talk about how we are celebrating six decades of the laser. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
So is it really that clear cut? Can we say that in May 1960, I think it is,
yes,
the laser appeared?
Well, kind of, yes. So what we're celebrating is the 60th anniversary of the 16th of May, 1960, which is the day that an American engineer and physicist called Ted Maiman first saw pulsed lasing in a crystal of pink ruby. And that was the first laser. But below that kind of top-level statement, there's a lot of things going on because Maiman and his assistant, Erne de Haenens, were definitely not the only people involved in the laser's early history. So the people who won the first laser-related Nobel Prize, which is in 1964, the official citation was for fundamental work in the field of quantum electronics, which has led to construction of oscillators and amplifiers based on the Maser-Laser principle. They were a pair of Soviet researchers, Nikolay Basov and Alexander Prokhorov, and also Charles Townes, who's an American, who co-authored an influential paper on infrared and optical masers, masers with an M, along with his brother-in-law, Art Shavlov. So they were kind of the ones who got rewarded for the laser's invention, and they were involved in the early development of it. But the laser paper design in the paper of Charles Townes and Art Shavlov has never actually worked. And this probably wasn't the first time the Nobel Prize Committee honored the theorist who did the background work rather than the experimentalist who put it into practice. And it certainly wasn't the last either.
And there's a great quote, isn't there, from de Haenens about the laser, describing it as a solution looking for a problem. And that's amazing today when you think of, you know, how many applications there are to lasers. But there weren't many obvious ones at the beginning, were there?
Well, I think they kind of were. I mean, it's interesting. The person who actually coined the name laser was yet another early pioneer, Gordon Gould. He's one of Charles Townes' students. And he'd independently come up with an idea for a sodium vapor-based device 3 years earlier in 1957. And he sketched out what he called some rough calculations on the feasibility of a laser, light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. And he did that in his lab book in November 1957. And he clearly thought that there were some potential applications here because he had the foresight to get his notebook notarized. But he didn't patent his idea because he thought, incorrectly as it turns out, that he needed to actually demonstrate a working device first. And that's one of the problems that led to a 30-year-long legal battle before he was eventually awarded some laser-related patents and millions of dollars in back royalties, in fact. So I think, yeah, there were actually some people who did think, even if there wasn't, you know, yet some sort of application, there was clearly were possibilities. I mean, lasers were being used for eye surgery and for industrial cutting within a few years of their invention. And you even see them in pop culture in that. There's a famous scene in the film Goldfinger, the James Bond film, where the villain has James Bond strapped to a table with a laser beam creeping ever closer to him.
Oh, right. Yeah, it is a laser beam. For some reason, I sort of remember it as a buzzsaw. Maybe that's another film I'm thinking
well,
of.
Well, interesting. It's interesting you say that, because in the book, which was published in 1959, which is a year before the invention of the laser, it's a circular saw, it's a buzzsaw. But the film Goldfinger came out in 1964, and so clearly it was the laser was present enough in the public imagination, I guess you'd say, for it to be, you know, replaced and used as a supervillain's torture technique.
Ah, that's interesting. That is interesting, because I have to say I'm not quite as old as the laser, but I can remember, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s and I was very, very interested in science. You know, I remember the laser as being a concept, but, you know, I don't remember ever actually seeing one. You know, on a table until I think it was probably when I was an undergraduate. And, you know, there was the ubiquitous helium neon lasers that pumped out red light and, you know, were used. I'm sure they still are used in physics labs up and down the country. So are there any other interesting early applications of the laser, Margaret?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the helium neon laser, or HeNe laser, because that was actually developed a couple of years later. But a lot of these early lasers, as with any new technology, they're actually really hard to operate and quite expensive. So another early type of lasers, dye lasers, were invented in 1966, and they had the advantage of working at a bunch of different wavelengths and also a broad range of wavelengths. They're very tunable. And here, the lasing medium isn't a gas, it's an organic dye. Or it's not a gas and it's not a crystal like the first laser was. It's an organic dye. And unfortunately, a lot of those organic dyes they're carcinogenic, they may erode metal, or they do other unpleasant things. Although, interesting enough, some of them are basically food coloring, which is why you can make Jell-O lays if you want to.
Wow.
Yeah. All sorts of things will laze if you pump them hard enough. But the point at which lasers really started to become ubiquitous, and they were actually so ubiquitous that you may not even sort of notice them, was with the invention of semiconductor diode lasers, which appeared in supermarket scanners from 1974. And I know you were around then.
Oh, I certainly was.
And then you also had laser discs and CD players come in the 1980s. So those were kind of the first consumer applications of lasers. And then a little bit later, yeah, telecommunications was huge.
I mean, I suppose the idea of a sort of solid state laser that you could integrate into an electronic system, that was really important, I would imagine, in the history of laser technology.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned briefly, telecommunications is a huge application of lasers these days. I mean, I'm talking to you right now, Hamish, because somewhere between my home Wi-Fi and yours, there's a laser sending pulses encoding my voice down an optical fiber.
Yeah, it is amazing. Yeah, I mean, as you know, as I said in the intro, it's very difficult to think of anything that we do these days in the modern world that is not sort of touched or affected by the laser one way or another. Yeah.
It's been a really good example of sort of technology push and application pull as well, because there's been tremendous strides in the development of lasers themselves, in terms of making lasers more powerful and expanding the wavelengths where lasing can take place, in diode lasers especially. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 15 years or so, that you could attend a talk at a physics conference on sort of why there weren't any good options for laser diodes in the blue and green region of the spectrum. Whereas now you can buy a blue or green laser pointer and just use it to drive your cat crazy if you want to.
I mean, you mentioned the development of blue and green lasers. What are current challenges at the moment in terms of developing new laser technologies?
Well, I think one of them is high power and low cost and good integration with other electronics. And you can read a lot more about those things. In honor of the 60th anniversary of the laser, we've created a collection of new articles about laser, as well as some highlights from our archives. And there's a great article on there about better blue and green lasers, written by Richard Stevenson. And also a piece about developing sufficiently high-powered blue lasers to weld copper, which is important for all sorts of industrial applications. Copper is hugely used in electronics, and particularly electronics for car batteries and that sort of thing. But copper, despite being sort of really high heat capacity, it doesn't it doesn't absorb heat very well at the sort of more common wavelengths of light of laser light for it. So the sort of roughly 1,000 nanometers that you get with telecommunications and some of the red range diode lasers, but it absorbs light much more strongly in the blue region of the spectrum. So the challenge has been to get a blue laser that was bright enough, powerful enough to melt copper. So there's a piece about that on our website now that you can read.
Well, that's really interesting because, you know, I suppose when you think of the applications of lasers, you think of, you know, sort of whiz bang, cutting edge, you know, concepts of quantum computing. And yet, welding, which is something that people have been doing for hundreds of years.
Oh, thousands, you know, probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You never would have thought that would be, an important challenge at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, lasers is used in, as you say, in fundamental physics. It's used in materials processing. It's used in medical treatments. As I said, there's a lot of, one of the early applications of lasers was really drove the laser market for several years, is for cosmetic applications. Tattoo removal is actually responsible for the commercial market for quite a lot of lasers out there. So, and of course, if you have a commercial market for something, even if it's something that, you know, you may seem like a little bit trivial, like cosmetic tattoo removal, that's going to actually drive a lot of innovation in the industry that can then sort of seep out into other areas. Another example of a technology that's really coming into its own in terms of laser technologies is LIDAR, laser imaging detection and ranging. It's an application that's been around for a while, but it's becoming much more common. It's used in both self-driving cars to detect obstacles and also for things like real-time monitoring of local airflow conditions for wind farms. And I think there's a really fun example of a LIDAR application, really serious in some ways, example of a LIDAR application that's on our website at the moment.
Yeah, this is a story about some scientists who have used LIDAR to study the behavior of mosquitoes in Africa. This behavior of these insects is of course very important because they spread malaria, which is a big problem. I think it kills about 500,000 people every year worldwide, and most of those people, unfortunately, are in Africa. And researchers, this is a group led by Mikael Brittegard at Lund University in Sweden. And what they've done is they've used LIDAR to observe mosquitoes, where they go, at what times of the day, by identifying them using LIDAR. And this, essentially what they do is they fire a laser beam out into the air, and some of the light reflects off the mosquitoes and it's detected. But, this detection is exquisite. They can actually measure how fast the wings of the mosquitoes are beating. And that, first of all, it allows them to identify mosquitoes, so they can tell the difference between mosquitoes and other insects. But incredibly, it also allows them to differentiate between male and female mosquitoes. And that is very important because it's the female mosquitoes that bite humans and spread malaria. And by doing this study, you know, they sort of looked at the behavior of mosquitoes near a village in Tanzania over a few evenings. And they noticed, you know, various patterns in terms of when the mosquitoes were on the move, when they weren't present. And they found that it depended on the time of day. Now, of course, now you're from North America, Margaret, so am I. We all know that mosquitoes come out when the sun goes down.
Oh, yeah.
So, that was nothing new, I suppose. But the interesting thing here is that I think it was probably just luck. They happened to be in this village when an eclipse came over.
And solar they found eclipse.
That's right, yeah, solar eclipse. And so they were actually able to do their measurements then. And they discovered that the mosquitoes were responding to light.
Okay.
So it wasn't, you know, they weren't, it wasn't,
cooler temperatures or something like that.
Exactly. Or is it circadian rhythm? It wasn't a circadian rhythm thing. They were actually responding to diminishing daylight. And so, you know, that I suppose could be useful in terms of controlling mosquitoes in certain areas. So yeah, that was that's a really interesting story. And another thing that I'm really fascinated by with LIDAR is its use in sort of seeing through vegetation to what lies underneath. And I think this has resulted in, you know, some really interesting archaeological finds. You know, it's sort of like a lost city in the jungle that nobody knew was there, because you know, the archaeologists were able to fly over with a LIDAR system and spot the ruins. And there's even some great images of in New England, where a lot of farmland has gone back to forest, essentially because it wasn't very good farmland in the first place.
Right.
So it's not worth farming today. There's these amazing LIDAR images of dry stone walls that were built, you know, I suppose when the first Europeans arrived in New England, they built these dry stone walls. And they've been, this system of walls has been completely subsumed by the forest, but LIDAR has you know, sort of revealed it. So that, yeah, there's some really interesting applications of LIDAR. And I should also say that we've got another article coming up about the applications of application of lasers. This is one, it's written by Edwin Cartledge. And it's about how some physicists have used lasers to cause one material to mimic the properties of another material. And I mean, it sounds interesting. I haven't quite got down to editing the article yet. It'll be up on the website when the podcast comes out. But I'm really interested in reading Edwin's article. And I'm sure you will be as well.
Oh, definitely.
And so you mentioned a few articles, Margaret. Is there anything else you'd like to highlight in terms of our special coverage of the 60th anniversary of the laser?
Yeah, be sure to have a look for an interview with some people who founded a company called Obsidia based on using lasers to etch inside diamond. So diamonds are commonly, diamonds and other gemstones actually are commonly laser etched on their edges to provide a tracking system. So you make sure that the stone is what it says it is and it comes from where you think it has, this kind of thing. But the problem with etching, even laser etching on a gemstone on the edge is that the edge is exterior. It can be polished off. It can be counterfeited, this sort of thing. So this team of researchers out of Oxford University spun out a company that uses adaptive optics to get the laser to focus inside the diamond and therefore to write these you know, microscopic, you know, can't even be seen with a jeweler's loop, hallmarks, essentially, inside diamond. That's to be used for tracing the origins of diamond and keeping track of stones. So yeah, that's something you can read on our website.
Oh, that's fantastic. And yeah, all of these articles about the laser celebrating the 60th anniversary can be found on the Physics World website. And if you go to the homepage, the articles will be front and center. Thanks a lot, Margaret.
Sure thing, Hamish.
Next, I'm joined by our Madrid correspondent, James Dacey, who is just back, sort of, from the European Geosciences Union General Assembly. Hi, James.
Hi, Hamish. You okay?
Yeah, not too bad. Now, this event was supposed to have been held in Vienna. Were you actually planning to make the trek from Madrid?
No, so I did go last year. So this is an annual event. So yeah, as you say, it's the European Geosciences Union. So it covers the whole range, really, from climate studies, oceanography, mineral resources. And yeah, there's normally around about 18,000 people that attend the meeting in Vienna. I wasn't going to be able to go this year just because I've traveled quite a bit up until now and I basically hadn't been planning to attend. So I guess, you know, from my point of view, it was a good thing that they managed to then switch this online and run the event. So I got to attend, as you say, sort of in the end after all.
And do you know how many people participated online?
So I don't think it was the full 18,000. They were running talks via Zoom, like, you know, a lot of people are doing these days. And I know quite often the moderators would kind of give an update on numbers, and it tended to be around about the 500 mark. Because they had they'd planned to run a series of these keynote talks, and I think they call them grand debates as well, where they talk about, you know, pressing issue in the field. So they ran quite a few of those with the same original planned speakers, and yeah, they were getting about 500. So I mean, in the real world last year, I mean, it would have been a similar amount in person, yeah.
And what was the vibe like? Did you feel like you were at a conference, or was it a bit remote?
So I guess it was more relaxed because I could just, you know, sit back on my settee and listen in to the talks. They did a pretty good job of keeping the format of conference talks. So, you know, you had somebody who would introduce the speaker. You'd have the session conveners as well. And then there was a chance for us to ask questions to the speakers via the chat function. And, you know, they addressed some of them in the actual video recording and then got back to us afterwards. So in the end, I mean, they probably actually got to more people than they would have done had it been in person. They actually got to interact. But obviously, you know, you missed out on that person-to-person connection, which you only really get from a physical conference. You know, going as a journalist, you often meet some interesting people in the press room there, you know, filmmakers, news reporters. And so there was none of that, really. You know, you were kind of rocking up by yourself to your living room table and listening in. But yeah, just in terms of learning about these different topics, I'd say it was just as good, really.
And unfortunately, no lovely Viennese cakes and coffee. Or I don't know, maybe did you go to your local supermarket in Madrid and see if you could find a nice Viennese-style cake to eat while you chatted?
I should have done, really, shouldn't I? Maybe a couple of wheat beers as well afterwards. no, I mean, the food here in Spain is good enough, to be honest.
And you... You came away from the conference with some interesting stuff, didn't you? You've written two news stories for us. One of them was about how Earth observation data is helping scientists understand COVID-19. What was that all about?
So part of the conference is always devoted to space science. So you get representatives from space agencies turning up from the science divisions of ESA and NASA and the Japanese Space Agency. And I mean, people who've been following the research around COVID-19 quite closely might have seen that there's been a few studies recently sort of tentatively linking, say, mortality rates among COVID-19 sufferers with the amount of pollution they've been exposed to over a long period. So, I mean, I guess the problem with these studies, even though there is a body of evidence suggesting that, you know, people who are exposed to pollution can have lung problems and heart issues, the problem is that there's lots of confounding factors. You know, often these people live in quite congested areas where there's lots of pollution, but that also means there's going to be more transmission of the disease anyway because of the number of people. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these studies, at the moment, they're preprints and they're going through the peer review process. But the space agencies have realised, you know, this is a really important question that needs to be looked at. So, for instance, ESA, the European Space Agency, have created a portal where they brought together lots of data from their Earth observation suite. So there's one particular satellite, which is Sentinel 5P, which helps to track the nitrous oxides, which are linked with traffic and pollution from burning fossil fuels. So they brought lots of data and lots of maps into one place so that scientists can go to that and they can get the data. And there's also, there's a bit of an ongoing debate as well. There's lots of questions around the spread of the disease via aerosols. So as opposed to droplets, which is thought to be the main way in which the disease is spreading. You know, somebody sneezes and those larger droplets maybe land somewhere, someone touches it and then touches their face. But you get this finer mist, smaller doses of the virus, which can travel in the air. And it's just basically not very clear at the moment, you know, how long it might stay in the air, how far it might travel, whether that's enough to really have a significant role in spreading the disease. So this Earth observation data can also help to tackle that question as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, on a much smaller scale, those aerosols are that's the reason why all the dentists are closed in the UK. Because I was very lucky, well, if you can call it lucky, to have a dentist appointment just before the lockdown. And my dentist explained to me that they're just about to close because of this issue of aerosols. Because when a dentist, you know, uses a drill, for example, on your teeth, vast amounts of aerosols are kicked up. And it's, you know, sort of the uncertainty and fear about those aerosols that have all the dentists shut down at the moment.
Well, I think that's the thing, because, you know, even if the dentist were to wear a, you know, top grade mask and a visor, there are fears that maybe the aerosols could, you know, get into aircon systems and then it could spread around the dental practice and, you know, it could be a hazard for people sitting in the waiting room, for example.
That's right. So you can read James's article on physicsworld.com. It's called Space Agencies Redirect Resources to Support COVID-19 Studies. And James, you also came back with a story about elephants in Africa and how they're being tracked. What was that all about?
Yeah, these physicists and geoscientists get up to all sorts, don't they, with their research. So any excuse to go and visit a safari park in Africa, really. It's a story about elephants and seismology. So I know we covered this previously in Physics World. So researchers in the past few years have got interested in the fact that when elephants communicate with each other, they're perhaps more famous for those kind of high-pitched, you know, standing on their hind legs, trumpet sounds that you see in Disney films. But they can also make these lower sounds, lower frequency sounds, which actually go down so low in frequency that they go beyond the range of human hearing. They're called rumbles, these sounds they make. And I know within zoology, there have been studies suggesting that elephants use these sounds for long-range communication between herds. And one interesting thing with the sound is that obviously it can travel quite a long way anyway as an acoustic signal, as a noise. But it can also, because it's so powerful, it can couple with the ground and it generates seismic waves. So it actually travels through the earth like a mini earthquake. I know for some of the smaller female elephants, these seismic waves can actually travel further than the actual acoustic wave that emerges from the sound directly.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Yeah, because when I first looked at your story, I thought, oh, seismic waves, that's got to be, you know, the thumping of the elephant's feet as they walk along. But it's actually the noises that they make, these very low-pitched noises that travel through the ground.
Yeah, I think, I mean, also the footsteps, because they are so massive, you know, they do also generate seismic signals. And I think when I read the paper, it said that the seismic waves actually travel the furthest are the ones that come from when an elephant is in danger and it starts to run away, when they really get a pace on, you know, that's when you get these seismic waves that can really travel over several kilometers.
And I think in the article you mentioned that this could be useful for monitoring elephant behavior, and also sort of identifying the presence of poachers, for example, who presumably they would upset the elephants and the behavior would change, and that could be detected using these sensors.
Yeah, that's right. So I know this isn't the first time that scientists have studied these seismic waves with this idea of developing a system to prevent poaching, but also for animal studies as well, you know, for animal behavioral studies. The difference in this case is that rather than using, you know, very expensive, top of the range bit of scientific equipment, a geophone system, which can cost, when I spoke to the researchers, they said that they can cost anything up to $20,000 for that equipment. But instead of that, they've used something called a Raspberry Shaken Boom. So it was a startup campaign launched a few years ago. I think it was really aimed at citizen scientists and educators to give them a piece of equipment based on the Raspberry Pi small-scale computers.
So that's like a really basic computer that doesn't cost much money and can be sort of programmed in a simple way.
Yeah, I think they use them for all sorts of things, don't they? I know they're used in schools for projects, aren't they? So in this case, it was aimed at getting people interested in seismology, really. So studying earthquakes. So if you go online on their site, you can see there's a whole network of citizen scientists tracking seismic signals from earthquakes and ground tremors. But nobody had ever actually used it for this context of studying animals, looking at animal vibrations. The research is led by Oliver Lamb at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in the US. So they took five of these devices to a park in South Africa, where there's a family of seven elephants. And they were looking specifically at these, they called them reunion events, where so I suppose pretty much like a family reunion here of humans, you know, when people maybe haven't seen each other for a while, they get together and there's a lot of noise, a lot of vocalization.
Eating that fermented fruit again.
So it's the same with elephants, apparently. They've got a lot to catch up on. And they generate lots of this noise, and the researchers tracked the signals. And I think they had mixed results. They realized that with their particular setup, they couldn't track the signals over huge distances. But despite that, because of the low cost, this could be something that would be of interest, you know, maybe to a local project that hasn't got an unlimited budget, either for tracking elephants responding to the presence of poachers, or even they say that in the right conditions, they could even detect human footsteps themselves. So, you know, a direct signal of the poachers. It does sound like an interesting field of research.
You can read more about this fantastic application of acoustic and seismic sensors in James's article, which is called Tracking Elephant Rumbles Without Breaking the Bank. So, James, at the event, I think there was also a lot of reflection about what geoscientists can learn from the COVID-19 pandemic and how these lessons can be applied to tackling other global challenges, specifically climate change.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, at these meetings, there's always a bit of that. There's obviously geoscientists do research that does sort of step into the political sphere with, you know, the climate research. But I think, you know, that they have realized that with what's going on with the coronavirus pandemic, that they've realized that it's an important moment to kind of, establish some kind of unified stance, you know, on how research can have a positive impact for things like the COVID-19 situation and climate change. So there was, on the opening day, there was a declaration made. So six of the world's leading geoscience societies, so that included obviously the EGU, but also the American Geophysical Union, which is the American equivalent. And it was basically a statement saying that, you know, the research should be looking to support global challenges. And it had a 10-point kind of manifesto, really, looking at shared responsibilities and best practice within the field. There was lots of focus on openness, for example, and transparency to keep the public trust.
Well, that's good to hear, because unfortunately, it seems that on the political front, it's every country for themselves.
No, I mean, that's, it is obviously perhaps a more complicated thing to try and get political agreement across different, within the country and internationally. I mean, one point that one of the speakers made, so Jonathan Bamber, he's a former president of the EGU, and he was speaking in the session where they talked about that declaration. And he's obviously not pleased by the developments with the pandemic, but he did point out that it's very, very unusual, the fact that whenever in the UK, for example, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, is giving his updates to the media and to the country, he's flanked on either side. He's got the Chief Medical Officer, is it the Chief Scientific Officer as well? It's the same here in Spain. You have the Chief Epidemiologist, Fernando Simón. Whenever the Prime Minister is speaking, he's standing right there and he's talking to the nation. And, it's a very unusual time for that to be happening. And it's, his point was that we shouldn't take that for granted. And we should see that science has been elevated and scientists have been elevated in the past few weeks. And in order to maintain that after the virus subsides is to basically continue engaging with politics and to seek to be open and, to help the public understand the processes of science a bit more. And he believes that could help to maintain that trust, which, it's pretty high at the moment, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely some wise words there. So it sounds like this was a success. Are you planning on attending any other online conferences?
I mean, I've been dipping into quite a few of these online webinars. You guys, quite a few going on YouTube at the moment. In terms of conferences, I didn't really have any plans. I mean, this one, I suppose, in a way, it was a conference, but in a sense, it was also, just a series of presentations. And I know we had an article, didn't we, on Physics World? Somebody was talking about the Women in Graphene event recently, which was, admittedly it was a smaller event, but that used a slightly more sophisticated system where I think people turned up and they had an avatar. So you're in this kind of virtual conference world where there were more opportunities to interact and ask questions, and you can kind of move around within this world. And, it'd be pretty cool to try something like that. It'd be nice to experience, to see if that can in any way recreate the real world experience. I mean, I guess I quite like conferences, really. I know some people find them a bit tiring and, probably pretty delighted with being able to do this from home. So yeah, I think, from my point of view, it doesn't replace the real world conference. And I wouldn't relish, just going to lots of these every year and never going to a real world event ever again.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on that one, James.
I mean, it does beg the question maybe about the need for these big international events. I mean, one idea that was discussed at this conference, they had a session on the future of conferences and this particular conference. And one idea was having smaller regional events. And I can see quite a lot of merit in that, rather than having this massive annual event where people are flying in from all over the world, why not just have a series of maybe more focused regional events, which could also be put online so people didn't miss out on the actual content, but you still had the chance to, to have that face-to-face interaction.
Well, that's great. Thanks, James. And you can read James's coverage of this online conference on the Physics World website. Thanks again, James, and we'll speak to you later.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up in this week's podcast is Physics World's Mateen Durrani, who is here to talk about why the print version of Physics World magazine is still mailed in a plastic wrapper. Hi, Mateen.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, originally, it was our plan to switch in May to a more environmentally friendly type of packaging for Physics World. But unfortunately, we had to put this on hold because of the pandemic. And the process of selecting a new wrapper for the magazine was so fascinating that we commissioned Susan Curtis to write an article about it. And that article appears in the May issue of Physics World magazine, which is still wrapped in plastic. So what were the main issues here, Mateen, about changing the packaging material for Physics World?
Well, we've been running Physics World for how many years is it now? 32 years. And I think for as long as I can remember, Hamish, it's always been wrapped in a plastic wrapper that's known in the trade as polywrap. And the thing about polywrap, which is basically low density polyethylene, it is fantastic material. There's no getting away from it because it's cheap, it's see-through, it's robust. So if you're sending magazines around the world, it can withstand lots of different weather conditions, rough handling from postal workers, that kind of thing. So there's loads of really strong reasons for wrapping something in polywrap. It's a brilliant material. But of course, the big drawback with polywrap, Hamish, is that although you can recycle it in principle, a lot of people don't, and they just throw it in the bin. And from the bin, it ends up in landfill, and from landfill, it ends up in, well, it can end up in the oceans and be a danger to marine life. So plastic waste is a huge, huge problem. And like all organizations, Physics World is aware that it's important to be as environmentally friendly as we can. So we decided to sort of look at what the alternatives were to that polywrap.
Yeah, it's interesting that it can be recycled. I mean, I think that was a bit of a surprise to me, and probably a surprise to a lot of readers. But there's a big problem, isn't there, that it's not normally accepted in curbside recycling. In fact, they don't want it in with other plastics. And so you have to take it to, for example, here in North Bristol, we can take it to our local supermarket and recycle it along with other plastic carrier bags. But it's there's certainly some confusion around the material, isn't there?
Yeah, there's definitely confusion. And sloth is another factor that people can't be bothered to take it away, so they just throw it away. And of course, the other big problem with polywrap is that it's made from crude oil. It's a fossil fuel derived material, and so there's all sorts of problems with it from that point of view. So changing to a different kind of wrapper is something that people have written to me as editor of Physics World quite a lot, and a lot of the emails we've received from people. And they've seen other organizations that they're members of, apart from the Institute of Physics, which publishes Physics World, they've seen other magazines wrapped in other materials. Now, one that's quite common is to wrap it in something called a sort of biomaterial. It's a kind of not as see-through as polywrap, and it's got a sort of more natural feel to it. It's more soft, it's sort of fluffier. And because it looks different, people assume that this material has many advantages. And of course it does. And often the material is kind of 30% starch, but it's mixed with a compostable plastic. So it still uses a plastic derived from fossil fuels. So it's better in that sense. The problem with those starchy materials is that you can't recycle them. It's even harder to recycle them than the polywrap. And so you could, in principle, bury it in your garden, that kind of thing. But, you know, a lot of people don't do that. So that has to be disposed of as well. And the other thing is the starchy material can't be recycled. So that kind of counts against it. So this thing that kind of looks very green has some downsides to it.
And there's a problem with recycling, isn't there, in the sense that you say it can't be recycled, but if for some reason you put it into a recycling stream, it could contaminate that recycling stream. So it could do much more harm than good.
Yeah, so the people who make that material, you know, tout its benefits, and it certainly does have some benefits. But you know, when you're mailing magazines around the world, Hamish, you know what it's like. They can easily get shredded or ripped or... and because it's not transparent, there is a particular problem with that in the sense that you can't guarantee that all postal systems around the world will accept it. And often if it's a case of reading barcodes on it and you can't see through it, that can be a problem. It can also be a problem if you've got adverts on the back of a magazine that can't be seen through the wrapper. So that kind of counts against that wrapper in some reasons. Therefore, that was the reason, the thinking was that we as physics world would change to a paper wrapping, which sounds quite a simple thing to do, but it's really only been in the last few years that printing companies have worked out ways of being able to wrap thousands of magazines in a quick period of time in a paper wrapper. I mean, you can't really sit there with somebody licking individual envelopes one by one. It has to be an automated process. And that's only really been available in the last couple of years. So paper has the big plus point of paper is it can be recycled and people do recycle it. And so that is a huge advantage of going to paper. It's not perfect either, because paper mills do consume energy and they do pump out wastewater with pollutants in there, although that in itself has improved in recent years. So there are huge advantages of paper, and that's why we decided as a physics world to switch to a paper wrapping. And that was before the pandemic took hold and kind of put those plans on hold for a bit, because we didn't want to change in May as planned, because there were so many other problems with postal systems around the world. Flights were being delayed, postal systems were going slow, and it just didn't seem the right moment to do that. So unfortunately, the May issue of Physics World, which was a special issue all about plastics, and this was going to be the moment when we were going to show our commitment to reducing the amount of plastic waste by changing to paper, unfortunately involved a few slightly awkward compromises, and I hope we've got the messaging quite clear that we will be changing to paper, but not quite yet.
And another option that Susan mentions in her article is sort of the no packaging option. I mean, I'm not quite sure what happens there. Do you put like a little piece of tape across the pages just to make sure the magazine doesn't fall apart and sort of slap a label on it and put it in the post and hope for the best?
I think that's the kind of thing which, you know, you could in principle do. It becomes a problem when you want to include inserts from other organizations, or if you want to have a supplement. Physics World often sends briefings, they're known now, on specific topic areas. And how do you include that in a magazine without a wrap around it? That can be quite difficult. So it can be done. It's called sort of naked publishing, but that's not something that we decided to do. It is difficult, though. And of course, it comes onto the question, Hamish, of, you know, why do we have a magazine at all? And that's a sort of more sort of, I guess, sort of philosophical question, or, you know, it's a business question. I know.
You mean a print magazine?
Yeah. Why would we have a print magazine at all? Why not just make everyone read the Physics World app, which is, you know, we have that. We've had that for many years now. The problem is some readers, you know, really love print magazines. There's a real attachment to it. It's something tangible. It's a sign that, in our case, the people who receive it are members of the Institute of Physics. It's a very tangible sign of their membership of that organization. And they, you know, they often really enjoy reading paper. There's a different feel to it. So it remains very popular. And I should admit, of course, that advertisers do like it, because there's money to be made from selling adverts to companies, and they in turn can promote their products and services to a huge number of readers very quickly and easily. So a print magazine is still something we will be doing for the foreseeable future. No changes on that front. But yeah, obviously printing out a load of pages and sending them has an environmental cost. But then, you know, so many things do. Even, you know, if you do a Google search, Hamish, that uses energy quite a lot, actually. So nothing is totally green when it comes to anything, any aspect of our lives. And I suppose it's a case of reducing and minimizing things where you can.
That's really interesting, Mateen. And in her article, Susan, you know, sort of tries to weigh up the pros and cons of the various packaging technologies, you know, from that point of view. What does the least harm I suppose. You can read Susan's article on the Physics World website. It's called Physics World Unwrapped. And that is in the May issue of Physics World magazine. So what are some other highlights in this month's issue, Mateen?
As I mentioned, the May issue of Physics World is a special issue all about how to avoid, track, and recycle the amount of plastic we use. And there's two other big features in there that I can recommend. The first is by Anna Deming, all about new approaches to recycling plastic waste. And of course, if we can recycle waste, that's got to be a really obvious way of minimizing the amount of plastic waste that ends up in landfill or ends up in the seas. And talking of the oceans, the other feature is by Marek Stevens, who talks about the problem of what's known as dark plastic. So a little bit like dark matter, it's stuff that, you know, is out there, but we can't see it. Dark plastic is plastic that's kind of so microscopic that it's ended up in the oceans and it's just floating around and we can't spot it. And he talks about satellite technology being one solution to sort of mapping where it is and being able to detect it. It's harder than it sounds. It's quite a difficult problem. And certainly there's calculations suggest that the amount of plastic that we can see in the oceans is far less than we know should be there, hence the term dark plastic. So that's by Marek Stevens, and they're both available on the Physics World website as well.
So those articles are called Plastic That Doesn't Cost the Earth and The Search for the Missing Plastic, and both of those can be found on the Physics World website. That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Margaret Harris, James Dacey, and Mateen Durrani for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. This podcast was brought to you by Teledyne Hastings Instruments. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.